Francis and Michael Holmes are local historians. They have written books on a wide range of subjects, including the history of Norwich pubs and breweries, the marketplace, and the story of the boot and shoe trade. Michael Hutchinson spoke to them about their latest book, which focuses on the city directly after the Second World War. He started by asking why they picked on this particular period of history.
We chose this subject for our book, the 1950s or 1945 to 1960, because it had featured so much in our previous books. We talked to people and they mentioned what they were doing over that period, and it just seems a fascinating time. And also we were very conscious that it was one whereby if we didn't start talking to people, it would be forgotten. It is a generation that's fast disappearing, and if you don't catch the memories, I think it was pretty clear that we had to catch people when we did the book on the boot and shoe trade, because that had folded so quickly. We got so much of our information from people who worked in it. But sadly, by the time we published the book, a number had passed away, so it was lovely to get their memories while they could still share them with us.
Large parts of Norwich suffered bomb damage in the war, and I suppose that gave the city an opportunity to sort of recover in all sorts of ways and possibly move on from wherever it was in the early 1940s.
One of the other reasons for doing the 1950s was that quite a lot of people look back on that period as a very black and white period, and didn't think it was particularly interesting. It's a bit of a boring period. But of course, it was a tremendously important period. As you say, it was after the Second World War, and Norwich was very much in a recovery stage. It had been hit badly. It was beginning to put itself together, and it achieved an awful lot in a very, very short time. That's one of the reasons why we subtitled the book From Austerity to Prosperity, because in that tiny period of time, 15 years, Norwich came from being devastated to being a thriving centre for manufacturing and commerce.
Some of the areas which particularly evolved, you've got to think of housing. Between 1945 and 1955, 6,500 new council houses were built. We had estates like the West Earl and the Tuxwood, and what was the last, the biggest and the best, the Heartsease. You saw 130 factories had been bombed during the war. When they rebuilt, they started to reinvent themselves. They obviously updated their factories, their machinery, but over this period, you started to see them move out of the centre of the city to the outskirts. Take Harmer's, the clothing manufacturer, originally based on St Andrews, gets demolished in the war, rebuilt on the Marcross estate, but by the time we get to 1957, it's been described as one of the leading clothing manufacturers in the country.
Just to pick up on what Francis said about the housing situation, of course, like the rest of the country, directly after the Second World War, there was an enormous shortage of housing. But Norwich really attacked that problem, built a tremendous number of council houses, and by the time we get to, I think it was
1957, by the time we get to 1957, the Evening News is running this huge headline, "Too many houses?"
Now, if you can put that into what's happening today, you can see what an enormous achievement it was coming from a bankrupt state to a state of full housing.
Can I move on to the role of women? Because obviously during the war years, out of necessity, a lot of women had sort of emerged from the kitchen, as it were. Do you think they were reluctant to go back to that sort of role after the war, having worked in factories and quite heavy industry in some cases?
Well, a lot stayed in the factories, obviously, but they tended to get demoted. I think we had a nice story about Lucy's, the glass and china shop. Basically, all the men went out to war and the ladies became buyers as well as shop assistants. But after the war, they then went back again into their shop role. I suspect, as with all walks of life, it's 50-50. Some wouldn't have wanted to return, others would, but we didn't cover it in any huge detail.
But we did look at some of the attitudes towards women in the 1950s.
I have to say, when we were doing the book and we were doing research, I was reading through some of these articles of women and in the workplace and how they were sort of patronised, talked down to, and they were little dears. And I have to be honest and say I felt very cross.
While we're speaking about women, of course, as people got more and more affluent, they were able to buy all these wonderful gadgets which we'd never had before, like vacuum cleaners and washing machines and refrigerators, and supposedly they gave women an easier ride. Is that really true?
I think it's when you're coming towards the... It's only the end of the 1950s that you're starting to see this really upsurge of goods at the home. So only after the Second World War that houses are wired for electricity as standard. Mm. So that's the first thing. After the war, we've got to remember that we still had rationing and... Well, food rationing went on until 1954. We had utility goods. So it's only as we get towards the end of the 1950s that these gadgets are really beginning to appear. But by the time we get to the 1950s, vacuums, because you didn't really need a vacuum and didn't have a carpet sort of thing, and you didn't have electricity, so you got to see the vacuums. Fridges are beginning to appear.
Fridges make a big difference because it then means you haven't necessarily got to shop every day for perishable things. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in those days, in the 1950s, everyone would shop at their corner shops. They'd all have their local shops. They would go down the city occasionally. They might visit the market or something.
We didn't have a supermarket in Norwich in the 1950s. We did have multiples which had local stores in Norwich. So we had a Sainsbury's, say, on the Haymarket. We had the international stores on the Haymarket. But they weren't self-service. Norwich didn't actually have a supermarket until in the 1950s.
Well, you hear lovely stories of going into, say, Sainsbury's on the walk, and the tops would all be marble, and there would be several registers to where you would pay your money. So you'd go to the cheese counter and you'd pay for your cheese. And then you go a bit further down and you'd buy your fish, perhaps, or whatever. And then you'd go buy your tea. And you'd have to pay several different times. Totally different way of shopping to what we have today.
Also, especially you think it's only as we get to the end of the 1950s, people are starting to get cars. So you weren't doing huge shops because you weren't couldn't carry stuff home. So.
People, obviously, you'd have to be fairly well off to buy a car. But more cars started to appear on the roads, you know, like the Morris Minor and the Ford Popular.
Yeah.
And then, of course, eventually, at the end of the era, there was the Mini.
Oh, the Mini.
Icon of the 60s, but very much designed and built initially in the 1950s, end of the 1950s. One of the things about Norwich is, of course, it's a medieval city. And it wasn't built for cars. And after the Second World War, there were very grand plans of how the city would be totally changed to be able to accommodate the car. Of course, nowadays, we go the other way. We want to keep the cars out of the city centre. To be able to control the traffic, the policeman on point duty was very, very common sight. You don't see it as often nowadays, but of course the famous one was the white box outside what was Coles, now Debenhams. And the policeman we spoke to, used to be there at the time, said that was a wonderful shift. We should stand in that box and you were omnipotent. You could control everything. But the other side of the coin is the policeman on point duty at the bottom of Grapes Hill had a totally different story, because he was standing there with no protection and there might be 200 or 300 bicycles charging down Grapes Hill. Whether they had good brakes or not, he had no idea. But all he had to stop them coming straight into them was a white glove to put up his hand and say stop, and kept his fingers crossed.
One topic I got here was about seaside holidays, which you put in your book. I know a lot of people, Norfolk people, traditionally would probably have a day's outing, and, you know, that would be their holiday. But in the 50s, people started to go away. They might not go very far, but you had the era of the holiday camps coming into being and people going to the seaside much more.
I think people started to get the holidays as we got into the 50s. Butlins, of course, that was, although set up before the war, after the war, that got very much more publicity. So in this area you had not so much the Butlins, but then you had all the other holiday camps that people went to. And obviously they didn't go very far, so you had Galston, Yarmouth, Cromer, and people could start to afford to go on little holidays, but very few people were going abroad, although obviously in the 1950s, that was when you started to see the rise of the package tour.
The seaside towns like Great Yarmouth and Stanton all seem to be booming when you look at photographs at the time, you know, the beach is covered in people.
But it's your pre-going abroad. People have got a bit more money, they want to go away, transport is improving, And obviously as well, because a lot of people in the city work in the factories, all tend to go the same couple of weeks, so you end up having these
trips to the coast. About the rise of the motor car, but in the 1950s, the majority of people still did not have a car. And we've got a lovely picture in the book of Thorpe Station on a bank holiday, and the queues would literally be thousands and thousands of people would queue up to catch the several trains that were going, mainly to Great Yarmouth, and that was a big festival holiday. They would go to Yarmouth, they sort of had their routine worked out, they'd have a wonderful day, they're doing all the silly things that people do, and then take a whim in the evening, and that was a highlight of the year.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about television, because it became a big factor for change, really. Television had really been shut down for the war years, but Norfolk was never really served very well for television because the reception came from Alexander Palace, presumably, which was a long way away.
Television didn't take off quickly in Norwich. Cinemas continued to boom up to sort of around about the mid-1950s, but it all changes in 1955. Firstly, in 1955, we have a transmission mast built at Tackleston. So suddenly, rather than watch the television and just see little bits of white going backwards and forwards, which was the big problem, they started to get very, very good pictures. But it was 1959 was the next really big change, because that was when a huge blaze of publicity, Anglia Television, is launched. And suddenly you get two channels. And the impact on cinema and going out is very, very clearly illustrated by the fact, I think it was between 1953 through to 1961, seven cinemas close for good. And also we see the death of the Hippodrome Theatre on St Giles, which again just couldn't compete with upcoming television. Coronation gave a huge impromptu sort of push for television. But still, although people got them in Norwich, it's quite interesting. When we were researching the book, we used Evening News, EDP, local papers. And again, there were a number of reports about how bad transmission was in Norwich. Mm-hmm. So yes, although it did give it the boost, but you also found it gave a boost for the cinemas. People were queuing round outside. They wanted to see all the pictures of the coronation, etc. Yeah.
In colour.
In colour, yes. There was two different colour films of the coronation.
So the television was actually... And I can't quite remember the figures, but there were huge reports from that Norwich was one of the few cities in the country where audiences were still booming and growing through to the 1950s, and then it started to die off.
The other thing that I was interested in your book was the emergence of the teenager.
Yeah.
It was as if teenagers never existed until the 50s.
Well, they didn't really. They were young men or young ladies. There wasn't really this classification of teenagers until you get to the 1950s, and of course it came off from the States with people like Elvis Presley. But really, it was when you got the music coming across, jazz, skiffle, then of course rock and roll, that teenagers were able to identify themselves as something a little bit different. The war years were behind us, and the teenagers didn't really remember. They remembered the war, but it was something in their childhood, and they were a new sort of person almost, and they wanted to be able to just show that they were a little bit different. And of course, the music, and then the dress, and the attitudes.
Were you ever a teddy boy, Mike?
No, I was more of a rock. I say a rock. I was more of a biker.
You surprised me.
Yeah. I had a Triumph, and we used to play. Well, you used to take it to bits and put it together. Yeah. It was a T120. Sorry, T100. I actually bought it from quite a well-known rocker in Norwich called Ray Pace. Right. He lived on the Tuckford estate at the time.
Because my memory is of the, this is totally against you, is the rise of the scooter.
Oh, yeah.
Scooter. Well, because we were mods.
Yeah, they were mods, the other side. We couldn't really understand what the attraction was, but again, you see, this, you're getting into the 1960s now, obviously, but it was fashion, and it was more trendy, and the mods were smarter, and it was, again, the teenager of the time trying to identify themselves for their particular era.
And the youngsters had money, and they had jobs, and they could afford to go and buy these things.
And that was one of the big things, is that for the first time, You had this group of young people who had spare cash to spend on non-essentials. So suddenly they have the cash to spend. But also there was this huge rebellion that they wanted to be different. So they had the cash so they could spend it on clothes, they could spend it on going to the cinema. And it all goes together to get this group who were suddenly defined.
And even Teddy Boys, people often thought of the Teddy Boys as being sort of, they were the sort of dangerous ones of the time. When you talk to them,
but not in Norwich, I think.
Hey, well, we just like dressing up, they said.
We're talking about youngsters. Do you think it's important that the youngsters of today have some knowledge of all this? Because it's so alien to them, you know, what they have today and all the immediacy of entertainment.
I think it's essential that people look back at what happened before. I don't think that people appreciate how much we have today. You look at this period, we had this period of rationing where literally people, they had what they had and you couldn't have anything else. You couldn't just keep going out and buying. You're recycling. But the message you got over again and again was that we made the most of what we had and we enjoyed it more and we didn't have all this pressure. And I think one of the big things you find about children, you find that people had all this freedom to go out and play. Because you didn't have the technology, you didn't have the car on the street, people went out and they lived totally different lives. And I think today, if you don't look back at what happened before, it was a simpler way of life, but for many people it was a happier way of life.
Yeah. If you look back at the sport directly after the Second World War, then one of the most popular sports in the city and throughout the UK was cycle speedway. It sounds silly, but the kids after the Second World War, they could make a track. Plenty of waste ground around, they could cobble together a bicycle and they could race around tracks. And there were dozens of clubs in Norwich and Norfolk. And there were national leagues. And we had some wonderful cycle speedway riders.
And I think as well as you now sort of hear, oh, we've got our Facebook friends, etc. We didn't then. You went out to play. You made real friends. And I think that this was the year where suddenly you have the welfare state, the housing's improving. People had lots of jobs, and I'm not saying it was perfect, and obviously there were lots of things which are better today, but maybe it's always looking back and picking and choosing and seeing what you would like to promote to continue to this day. So yes, we always learn from the past. And
you've gone into really what I was going to be my final question. I mean, you obviously spoke to a lot of people who lived through that particular era. Did you find many people sort of referring to it as the good old days and wish they'd gone back and not actually quite happy where, feel they're happier where they are?
A lot of people would look back and, as I say, pick and choose. That there are things, all right, you don't want the rationing, you don't want the utility goods, but people said that they often appreciated what they had more, especially the childhood where they could go out to play in the freedoms that they had. That definitely came through. But, you know, it's nice to have a warm house, isn't it? Let's not delude ourselves. It is nice to have a warm house. It's nice to have the good food, in the supermarket, the convenience. But as I say, a lot would turn back and say, but they were very happy days.
If you think that Francis and Michael's profusely illustrated book, Norwich 1945 to 1960, A Journey from Austerity to Prosperity, if you think it would make a good Christmas present for a family member or a friend, it's obtainable from Jowls or Waterstones, priced £9.95.